I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Hello and welcome to this very special interview where we should be talking about all sorts of things. And I am joined by the legendary Mr. Gavin Bobey. How are you, sir?
Very well. Great to talk to you again, Bo.
Yeah, no, great to have you back. You have been on Lotus Eaters before, which was a great conversation. So, yeah, it's been too long. It's high time we've had you back on.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, so there's lots we can talk about. Perhaps maybe we can kick off with some of your more legendary work with mosque busting. That's one of the things you're well known for, is actually getting involved in the legal side of things to try and prevent mosques from being built, or indeed existing buildings from being converted into mosques. How's all that going?
Yeah, that's going fine, still plodding along. What's changed is my initial motivation was simply I couldn't stand sitting back and shouting at the telly, shouting at the radio when I heard the bad news. I wanted to do something about it, maybe help a neighbourhood, because a mosque is a horrible thing to have in your neighborhood. It's just awful. You become unwelcome fast when you get a mosque in your area. But what it's changed to, my motivation now is actually much more that mosques are fortresses. And as I've become more, over the last few years, more interested in how we reverse the invasion, the mass immigration invasion, I found that mosques again are at the center of it, because mosques are fortresses. They will be like buffers in the way of us trying to peacefully remigrate. So I think every mosque that we prevent getting in place now, I would estimate that cost, that saves maybe three soldiers' lives, because taking a fortress is not easy.
Yeah, God, I mean, well, we're getting down to brass tacks right away, yeah. So yeah. You've talked about how before, and I guess we'll have to touch on it again in case anyone didn't see our early conversation or aren't particularly aware of you, the idea that where it doesn't always have to be a full-blown mosque. It can be sort of an Islamic centre, or it can be even in some sort of Islamic, quote-unquote, bookshop. But that, as you describe it, it's like some sort of bastion then. That's some sort of castle or base for them from which to radiate outwards an enclave, a foreign enclave in England or in Britain, all over Britain. And so these are sort of, you know, very strategically or even tactically speaking, geographically, literally, physically speaking, these are things that need to be looked at. You know, they need to be taken seriously, because if and when there is some sort of mass remigration effort, and it literally comes down to physically having to deport people, this is what it will boil down to, that they will be their bastions, for want of a better word. And so, as you say there, each one, every single one that can be prevented or converted back into some non-Islamic bastion is sort of vital work.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's just in case people don't know, what I do is I stop mosques getting planning permission. So when they set up, I prevent them getting set up in the first place. And the way to think about it, the way I think about it, it's a bit like Henry VIII going over to Ireland and building a fortress, basically saying, this is my area now. And so you're not just having to, you're not just kicking me out and my Whig emissary that I send out there. You're having to retake a whole fortress, so you can't get rid of me. And mosques have a similar function. That's the primary function. It's not for contemplation of the divine. It's for politics and blessing armies, sending armies into battle. I mean, all that routine that people are familiar with. So it's you don't only save the neighborhood, you basically make it a lot easier to retake a whole area, or in eventually, I think, the entire country, by removing the fortresses, because those fortresses delineate territory. And the smaller and more congested your enemy's territory, the weaker they are, basically, the less room they have to train, the fewer resources they have. And the weaker they are, the more options you have available when you want to remove them. And then the more options you have available, the more humanely you can do it. So I think it is actually, Muslims won't see it this way, but I think when it comes to the process of mass remigration, it is in fact much kinder to have made sure that their territory is restricted, minimized and congested as a result of preventing those forward operating bases getting established. And because that means we'll be able to be much more humane. And I can see perhaps some parts of Europe, the danger is some parts of Europe might resort to competitive atrocity in order to remove foreign populations. But if you can separate out and make sure that your opponent, your enemy, is weak on the ground he stands on, it means you can just be nicer about it. You don't have to resort to violence, basically, which is why I think it could be. What I hope is, I base some of my hope on that it could be an easy, relatively straightforward process.
I mean, hopefully, because I mean, what we're talking about here, I suppose, like sort of the nightmare vision of the future is sort of full balkanization. What happened in Yugoslavia?
Yeah.
Something like that. That's the real nightmare vision of the future. A few things you said there that could be pointed out. One, first thing you said was that it's just terrible to have a mosque, certainly a big mosque in your area, because, I mean, one of the things is, that they will then, for want of a better word, colonise the surrounding area, i.e. With the chain migration and mass immigration, they buy up or rent all the houses nearby, literally in a concentric area around it, and then native people, or not even native people, anyone that isn't Muslim is sort of one way or another forced out. And of course there's the call to prayer. What an abomination to see in places like Blackburn or something, the call to prayer in ridiculously early hours over an English town. But that's sort of the least of it, really. But then, yeah, the idea that the actual real physical process of remigration hopefully could be non-violent, hopefully. That is, so for example, in Swindon right now, there's this old church. It's actually quite close. And it's an old, it's a derelict church. It's actually the facade, the outside, the shell of the building is actually quite big and grand, but it's completely derelict. I think it's gutted on the outside. Certainly all the windows are boarded up and sorts of things. Anyway, there's some sort of legal process wrangling going on because they're trying to have it bought, the site bought by some sort of Muslim group. And they're openly saying we'll turn it into a mosque.
Yeah.
So what sort of thing can be, what sort of thing can be done? What sort of thing have you done in the past, actually getting down into the weeds of what can be done?
Well, normally, if you're trying to stop a mosque going ahead, it's rare that they go ahead and try to convert a church. I'll come to that in a second. Normally, what you do is you stick to the polite, hypocritical English planning code. So it's all about traffic. It's all about disturbance in the area. It's all about architecture. Like, I don't mind the call to prayer. I don't mind that my wife risks getting sworn at and beaten up when she wants to go past the area with the dog whilst there's a service on. No, I don't mind any of that, but it breaks my heart to see such bad parking around here. So, that's the kind of hypocrisy that people, if you start mentioning religion or politics, that's the fast way to lose, because the decision maker, he'll basically look at the smooth shaven gigolo who's fronting up the mosque application, and he'll say, can you assure me that there will be no extremism at this mosque? And he'll say oh yes sir, I can, or rather no, oh yes, I can assure you of that. And then he'll say, well, that's good enough for me. So it goes in. So you really have to stick to the planning code. What I haven't talked about, because I don't want to give the enemy ammunition, but they're starting to do it, so I might as well come clean to you about it for the first time. And that is, if you have a church that is within a youth class that's called religious worship. Now, in general, when you're changing planning permission, this is what's called use classes. If you're changing from one use class to another, say from a shop to a factory, or from a house to, I don't know, to a shop, then that requires planning permission. But if it's within the same use class, it doesn't require planning permission in general. And just changing the nature of the religious worship doesn't require planning permission. And what I've been seeing for the last few months is very few ordinary planning applications coming up, but quite a few conversion of church projects going ahead. And people approach me, and that at the moment, it's very difficult for me to deal with that, because technically there is no reason to object, or there's no reason for the council to refuse, because the Muslims don't have to apply for planning permission. So what they would say, it's a bit like, if you sell your house to me, I don't need planning permission to go and live in your house if I bought it. Do you understand? So, but what I find is there is always a weakness with every enemy. And I reckon what's necessary is to find a crack. There'll be some crack in that edifice. If I can get my fingers into it, my filthy fingers into it, and pry it apart, I can probably find a way through. But the problem is, most members of the public are not motivated. That would cost, just devising the strategy is going to cost about 10 or 15 grand, not to me, but I reckon I'll need to hire a good lawyer that I can knock heads with to work out a strategy that can then get replicated. But then subsequent applications become more expensive, because there's more legal wrangling to do. If I, the Golders Green application, there was a mega mosque application in Golders Green that had been used for Christian worship. So it was a big theatre, didn't work as a theatre, sold to a Christian organisation, they used it for Christian worship, and then an Iranian mosque outfit took it over, and I managed to get it stopped, and they packed up their bags and went, because I went for the throat, basically, which was really enjoyable, and they went. And that was because I was able to get my fingers into a crack and just pull the case open. And I think there must be a way to do it. In this instance, you might talk about intensification of use. You might talk about nature of use, fundamentally changing. I reckon that there ought to be a way. But everything comes down to money, and the fact that really in what we're doing, there's very little. I don't mind that. I understand people are going along. People need to do with their life. So people have other things to spend money on than throw 10 or 15 grand towards me to do that. But at some stage, if I'm able to do that, I reckon I'll be able to intervene. If I'm able to get that money to devise that strategy and then go after them, I'll be able to intervene with the kind of case you're talking about in Swindon. But at the moment, the Swindon case you're talking about, I think that mosque outfit are probably not going to submit an application. And if some of the local people go to the council and say, what's going on here? You should get a planning application, make them submit a planning application. I think the council would say, no, it's a job we don't want. We don't have to, and it'll go ahead. So I think we're going to see more and more of that, particularly with most official Christian organizations in this country being so openly treacherous that they celebrate the establishment of mosques. I'm sure that Swindon place, I bet there's some crabby old vicar saying to himself, isn't it lovely it's being used as a faith institution? So at the moment, I'm afraid there's not much I can do, and it's getting worse. But
someone in a dog collar holding up a piece of paper, hashtag we are all Muslims, and posting it somewhere. You must have seen that sort of thing. Yeah, complete traitors. a couple of things, though. So the money thing. Unfortunately, I'm not a rich man. If I won the Euro Millions, I would be bunging a shed load of cash your way, Gavin. But I personally, I can't be. If there's anyone out there that watches this, that's got a few bob and really cares about this, get in touch with Mr. Bobby and give him some money for this stuff, because it's vital. It's absolutely vitally important for to try and avoid a nightmarish future. The other thing, quick question I want to ask you before we move on a little bit. Is it the case, because I'm quite ignorant in these sort of things, is it the case, though, that the council, the individual councils, it's more or less at their discretion in the end, though? So if you've got a council that's completely or enough captured by Muslims, then they will act in a partisan manner and give the go-ahead to things, regardless of how hard somebody like your good self tries to thwart them. Is that how it works, ultimately?
Totally, yes. Unless there's a feud between different Muslim. So if the Muslim council is from a different Muslim organisation, they might then try and refuse it, because they hate each other almost as much as they hate us. But totally. It gets worse than that. There are a bunch of planning authorities around the country where if it's a mosque, you don't have to submit planning permission for anything. It doesn't matter. You just don't do it. No one's going to say a word, and the council are not going to come down on you at all. Bradford, I would say, is certainly like that. Right. I mean, I did this a few years ago. I looked on Bradford's website just to research and find out how have there been any applications recently, because you can guarantee there have been new mosques coming up in Bradford. And it took me years to go back to find any application for a mosque in Bradford. And that's because they just set up. I think other places, I think Oldham, Burnley might be becoming like that. Birmingham, I think, is probably like that by now. You can see the progression happening. One, where they consider them fairly, and then they become very, very biased in favour of them more and more. It's kind of a grey area. And then that's it. It's just total darkness.
So this is the kernels of the seed bed of sectarianism, balkanisation. This is the beginnings of, well, let's talk about a nightmarish future where big cities or certain enclaves, big pockets, are completely controlled by Islam. Yeah. Or it doesn't have to necessarily be just Islam. It could be any number of people. It could be a Hindu enclave, or it could be a Christian Nigerian enclave, or whatever it could be. You know, it could be some sort of area that's essentially de facto under the control of the CCP. Whatever it is, that the rule of the land, the English, is not in control there. And my worry is, again, I hope I'm not. I've been accused of being a far-right fantasist, but the worry is, the nightmarish fantasy, is that what you end up with is nearly every big city and even most towns are no-go areas and actually legally not in control of Westminster or the English common law or anything. And there's small hamlets or just more rural areas where native peoples have had to retreat to. And that's what the map of England looks like. And so, you know, anything that can possibly be done to avoid that. So it leads me on to my next question.
I'm in favour of that, though. I want to...
Oh, you're an accelerationist. You feel like that's necessary before we can actually...
No, I don't want us mingling. I want them separating themselves out hard, on really hard ethnic lines. Right. Because that is the key to removing them. That's the key to remigration.
So the ultimate goal is for to get rid of them, though.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And at some stage, to do that, you have to separate out. And if you get your enemy to fight the battle for you, you win. And 80 or 90% of remigration is just separating people out and just making sure that they're, and if they're prepared to do it themselves along hard lines, we're gonna be in our area and it's our area. You whitey, get out. Then that actually makes it a lot easier. So plus, I don't want them around me.
Well, no. So, I mean, so self-segregation like that is sort of in human nature in all sorts of ways. That's the way history has always sort of gone, you know. Safety in numbers, familiarity, and all that sort of thing. So that leads me on to the next thing I want to ask, or talk about at least briefly. Is this idea, this push, this concept of spreading out the invaders that are invading our islands, spreading them out, and the conscious decision, sometimes you see an article in The Guardian or something or other, all over the place, where they say, you know, the rural areas aren't diverse enough. Let's try and deliberately get whoever into much more rural areas, into every small town and hamlet and village. Let's have some sort of diversity. That seems to me sort of the essence of pure evil. That seems to me, because it's the opposite of what you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
It's the exact opposite. If someone were to, if it were a cynical plan, heaven forbid, then that is exactly what they would do, isn't it? I wonder what your thoughts are on that, that concept that you do sometimes see in something like The Guardian, saying every little town has to have, you know, even very small rural areas, let's get some, let's crowbar some diversity in there.
Yeah, it's about taking away people's identity. I think it is a cynical plan, except it's not, they're not bright enough to think it up. It's just people in power are doing what it's in their interest to do, increasing their power by making us easier to rule and more manageable. And that's what they want to do. There is no benefit whatever at all to immigration, mass immigration. There is none of it. It's economically, it's extraordinarily wasteful. It's extraordinarily bad for us financially, which is the case they always make. Culturally, it's extremely bad because these places are cultural desert.
Suicidal.
And that idea, we've got to push them out, disperse them into the country. That's a way of saying we're going to eradicate, we're going to sponge out any vestige of your identity. So you can't maintain a sense of identity anywhere. So the identity is made extinct. That's what that's about. And once that identity is gone completely, it's like destroying someone completely psychologically, not just partially destroying one aspect of their psychology. It's basically taking away the whole sense of identity, sense of autonomy. That's what that's about. And it's extremely unkind to the invaders, because when it comes to removing the invaders, I think the big, what I fear, my sort of fantasy fear, is I become somebody who has been part of ramping up to a welter of violence, creating a situation of massacre and atrocity. Now, I don't want my hands dirty with that. I don't want that on me. And the bit where all that violence takes place, I think, is the bit where you're trying to get people to separate people out and get them into small congested areas prior to removing them. And so if the government is sort of force feeding people right across the country, dispersing them across the country, that makes that separation, that essential bulk, that hard balkanization, it makes it much more difficult to achieve, because, well, it basically means that me and a bunch of my mates with a few pitchforks and torches and clubs, we've got to go around and say, here, get out of your house and, you know, go 200 miles to Birmingham, or the enclave in Birmingham, which, or maybe some rogue colonel in charge of a militia does it to people at gunpoint, like searching through houses. So I think it's incredibly irresponsible, incredibly evil, the authorities doing that, but particularly given their cynical black and white motives. There is no good element to their motives. It is entirely about power and achieving power through grinding us down. And it has to be stood up to at some stage. If there is atrocity, it's on their doorstep, not mine. But I'm sure it's me they'll want to imprison for. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I reserve the word evil. I don't throw it around lightly. But that particularly seems to me, that's the correct word, evil. To do that, to deliberately try and make every tiny, tiny little village and hamlet. Anyway, so moving on, looking at that nightmarish future, how to avoid it from where we are. Obviously, we've got a Starmer government and they're as globalist and insane as anything we've ever had so far. So, but let's just somehow assume that at some point in the not too distant future, hopefully, there was some sort of government that had guts and balls, that wanted to do this, that had political will. We're in the fantasy realm already, so let's go there. Pretend we've got that. And they were prepared to do what was necessary. What would you say is necessary? What would be your roadmap? What are your ideas, recommendations for what needs to be done?
I think the best way to achieve it, this is where I disagree with some people who advocate a party political solution. I think the best way to achieve it is to get the enemy to do the work for you. Get them to fight the war for you if you can. It just goes a lot easier if you can do that. And What that really means is find some way that the enemy populations or the invader populations want to separate themselves out. So they want to balkanize, they want to get out of your areas, but also unfortunately to push English people out of their areas. So you get hardened separation. Now, that I think avoids 80, I think that could avoid 100% of the atrocity. I think in itself, on its own, that avoids about 80 or 90%. The way that I think that's likely to happen realistically is not through voting. It's not through a government with sense getting in. It's not through Keir Starmer getting a bump on the head and waking up a passionate remigrator. It's what it is through collapse. I think we're going to collapse our way out of this and not vote our way out of this. I don't think people, there's no sign so far that people are willing to vote for this. The voting, I think 14% of the vote went to Nigel Farage last time. That's the pinnacle of nationalist opinion so far, in his Union Jack shoes. Okay, so I don't think we're going to vote our way out of it. And then the state, I think, is too blunt an instrument to sort of sort and separate and then contain and then push out tens of millions of people. It is in the tens of millions of people. And I think a better way is, what I think is more likely is that the economy breaks down. So government finances break down, that causes the welfare state to break down. And that drives people nuts, because what people vote for is welfare. That's what people are still hypnotized by. Am I going to get my bunions done for free? I mean, I'm being cruel here, but that's what people want, is welfare payments. You can see that. Winter fuel payment, or the perversion of the legal system to get the Southport rioters, winter fuel payments, that's the thing that attracts all the attention. That's what people want. I think if the welfare state goes down, I think the state authority will go down. People will say, right, the reason we vote for the state, the reason we're prepared to submit to it, is for the welfare state that the state provides. And if it no longer does, we don't accept the authority of the state. I think that's when the state goes down. And I think when that happens, the problem you get is just pure crime when state authorities go down. Mm. That's the next thing. And that then causes people to group together, because when crime explodes, it's scary, because you just never know if someone's going to come crashing through your front window with a gun or smacking you over the head demanding money. And so you get people clubbing together, and people will only club together with people who look at, think and speak like they do. I think at that stage you get hard separation, very hard separation. So as you saw, I don't know if you remember the 2011 riots, what you saw was the sort of the posses of people that went around providing security for their area were very much along race ethnic lines. So Muslims doing it, Sikhs doing it, West Indians doing it, British people doing it. I think that's what will happen. I think you'll get then very hard separation out. And because I would not trust my safety to foreigners. I do, because I think they want to get me. They would love nothing. I think they're the people who want to steal from me. They're the people I fear. So I'm not going to, they're the burglar, they're the foxes. I'm not going to put them in charge of my hen house. That's the way I think about it. So, and then what you can have is, if you have that separation out, what that means is for the foreign population, the foreigners in their enclaves, is two things. The first thing is no more welfare state, which a lot of them like a bit of welfare. But I don't think that's the only thing. I think most of them are probably here to work, because wages are like 50 times higher than they are in Pakistan or Afghanistan or Somalia, more or India as well. So, but if they're then separated out and they're denied contact with the productive Western people, their areas plummet fast. I mean, like within a matter of weeks, they turn into starving, disease-ridden, lit garbage-filled, sewage-filled hellholes, really. So if you imagine, say, Bradford declares UDI, independence, and says, we're all Muslims here, we're kicking out all the white people, this this half of Bradford, that's ours. And then we say, fine, that's it. Yeah, it's walled off. You're not coming out into our area either. And let's suppose they've got no more welfare. I mean, I would invite your listeners, if you're near an invader enclave, if you feel safe, just walk inside and ask yourself, where are the self-starting sources of civil society, wealth creation? Where are the sources of order, healthcare, the basic amenities? None. It's all bought and paid for by us. So once they're separated out from us, if you think about it, healthcare goes down. I guess fire service goes down. So when they're cooking chapatis over an open fire in the living room, and the whole block of flats goes up, there's no fire. They can't call the fire service. And then there's no telephone because they're not paying the phone bill. Then there's no gas, so they can't heat the houses. That's pretty miserable. If you're a Pakistani, you're living in Bradford, that's miserable. And then there's maybe no electricity. And then there's maybe no water, or there might be, if we're nice to them, there's a standpipe in the middle of the square for 2 hours a day. And then maybe we say, we don't want your sewage. Your sewage is full of E. coli and polio. We don't want it. So we block off the sewers. Then what happens in those areas? Do you understand? So I'm putting it in a very vivid, harsh way. But the bottom line is, if they have to retreat to their own enclaves and they're denied interaction with us, you don't need to any atrocity. They inflict it on themselves because they can't, because of their inability to get up a decent society. I mean, imagine an enclave full of Shias, Sunnis, Hindus, Sikhs, and West Indians. I mean, it's going to be worse than Lebanon.
Yeah, and so
the one thing that we need, I think, to avoid that is law. So that if the state breaks down, we need to be able to find systems of law we can sign up to voluntarily, so that we retain the law, so that we can remain prosperous and functioning, which they can never do. And then it becomes very easy just to buy them out, if nothing else, just to say your block of flats in this dirt hole is worth it's we'll give you 10 grand for it, and it's not worth 100 quid to you, so you might as well just take the money and live like a god back in Somalia. So I think that's but I think it's collapse that's going to do this more than politics, or more than party politics.
So when we look at Gavin, come on.
My fear is that doing it down the party political route, that could be a recipe for the kind of violence that you and I, as the decent ones, the members, you know, the decent people, want to avoid.
Because when I wrote a roadmap, quote unquote, for Mallard magazine a while ago, which got me deselected from Reform in the bad books of Hope Not Hate, I said explicitly in that, you know, this and that needs to happen, da 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 da. And but one, the overriding goal is to do it without disgracing ourselves. It's another way of saying, you know, without any sort of atrocities. But when you look at history, I mean, exactly what you've been describing has happened throughout history many, many times. One of the things that kept popping into my mind while you were speaking, and pops into my mind, unfortunately, semi-regularly, is the example of partition in India in the late 40s. And obviously that was on a much grander scale than could ever happen in England. So there's a giant, giant example not that long ago. And if anyone who doesn't know, when the Raj, when the British government essentially left India, breaking off, there was both Pakistan and Bangladesh, or they called it, East Pakistan at one point. Anyway, breaking off on both sides of India was Pakistan and what we now call Bangladesh. And so there was a giant movement of people, millions and millions of people, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of people, separated themselves out. And this is over the space of a few weeks and months, very, very quick, small space of time, essentially, for what happened. Giant movements of people, mainly Muslims moving into what became Pakistan and Bangladesh, and lots of Hindus and other people moving out of those areas, both exactly what you've been describing. Mm-hmm. And it was atrocious. Mm-hmm. As it was going on, both sides massacring each other on the roadsides terribly. Men, women and children, just some of the most atrocious things you can sort of imagine happened during that splitting out stage. So it's exactly as you described. I think if anyone's out there who was listening to you just then and thought, well, that's an extreme scenario, I don't think that's likely to happen. It is likely to happen. That is how it goes.
Yes, yes.
And so that's the worry. So if, we can get the invaders to sort of self-segregate as much as possible before it comes to some sort of collapse point or some sort of point where the actual deportations need to happen. I mean, so in your idea then, in your view, your vision of the future, it would if there's a collapse of the state itself, essentially, then it would largely depend on people to self-deport, self-remigrate. You don't envision some sort of government program where there's sort of a giant department for remigration which goes round and removes people and physically buses them to airports, physically puts them on planes in the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, in the millions, and flies them back to their countries of origin. You don't see that then?
I think that could happen. If I talk about the state going down, what I think could replace it is actually a very organized society. And what I base that on, just because I'm on my background, I'm a lawyer, but the need for law is actually primal. The idea is that I think it's often thought of that no one wants to submit to the law. If given the choice, everyone would say, no, I don't want the law restricting my behavior. But the opposite is the case. We all need to show that we have submitted, or we are subject to some kind of legal system in order to be able to be trusted to live near other people and in order to be able to trade with other people. So if I said, send me your car, Bo. Ask the check's in the post. Okay. And by the way, I'm a bankrupt Somali in Mogadishu. You're probably not going to take the check, right? So you're not going to do it. So whereas if it's me and you know you can sue me, you might take a risk. You might say, well, I can sue him and he doesn't want that. So well, you still might. If it's a car, you might not. But financial transactions, mortgages, things like that. You need law. So I think law is a primary human need. Probably after food and shelter, maybe even more of a primal need than sex. But it's very high up the list. And I think that I suspect what's likely to happen, because I think the model of I'm digressing a bit, but I think the state is defunct. I think we're living at the very, very beginning of the prelude of the introduction to the end of the age of the state, simply because when you get a state, you get a welfare state, and then the welfare state gets so big, it collapses the state. That's basically. And if that happens and you're not subject to the state's law because the state's gone, I think people will voluntarily, we will rush to sign up to just private legal codes that you don't vote on, you just join, you vote with your feet. And so people collectivizing voluntarily. And in those circumstances, I can see people making very practical, tough decisions. So again, to illustrate, if I said, here's this legal system I've got up, Bo, I've got one that allows any invader, the whole 57 varieties, to live in it. And there's one doesn't allow, it's only good British people. It's a no-brainer which one you're going to join, because you don't have to pay to imprison all the invaders who commit crimes, basically. So apart from anything else. So if people, I can see people then collectively saying, we are part of this system, and thinking collectively. And when people think collectively, I think people are willing to put money towards and effort towards getting their territory back. I think what I'm describing sounds like a very unpatriotic, chaotic, anarchistic system. I think it would turn out to be highly moralistic, very cohesive, and quite repressive. Quite sort of personally repressive, which are the ingredients you need when you're wanting to get rogue populations out of your country. Because I think if people voluntarily, when you have a mollycoddling state saying we take care of all problems, people say, well, to hell with civilization, I don't need civilization, I'm taken care of. But if people are forced onto their method, people realize the value of civilization, and people will group together. They will do their bit. They will club together because they realize that there isn't, there's no other protection. So I could see, so let's say, putting it simply, state breaks down, everyone joins these a private legal code. I can see the people in it actually being really quite happy to say, no, I'm happy to put in a bit of money. I'm happy to contribute to the busing fund to get these people out to the airport if they want to go. I'm happy to get rid of them. What you might see is just someone like me, so a shyster like me, I might come to you and say, hey, Bo, invest a grand in this property fund. I'm going to go to the big fire-breathing Imam, who happens to own 100 houses in his area, which he's bullied out of the local population. And I'm going to offer him £100, or I'm going to offer him £1,000 per house. Each of those houses is worth £500,000 in our hands. But in that hellhole they're living in, he's not getting any rent because nothing's being done. So he'll sell to me, he'll sell those 100 houses for a grand apiece, because then he can go back to Pakistan with 100 grand in his pocket. And then I'd say, and then you get, say, 100 grand out. You multiply your money 100-fold, I'm tenfold, let's say, by Christmas. And then I keep the rest, you know, I make a profit. So that's the sort of thing that will, property passes from the low bidder to the high bidder. It's always a way. And so I think that can be done. But I think it will be pushed along by a much more patriotic and nationalistic identitarian sense that you get when people are having to rely on their own metal together. That's what I'm saying. I hope that's clear. I'm explaining quite rare.
It's absolutely, it's very, very interesting. Lots of things come to mind when you're speaking. A couple of things popped into my mind. Is one where you said that sort of law is primordial in some ways. Yeah, I absolutely think so. I think the thing that sets us apart from the animals, from the beasts, are things like language, tool making, and then law, right? Yeah. I'm an ancient historian, first and foremost. That's my actual background, is ancient history. And of course, you know, you look at things like the Code of Hammurabi or the Laws of Solon or whatever it is, right? It's what sets us apart from being just merely hunter-gatherers. What you said, it absolutely set my imagination alight. Where you say, it's what allows us to live together.
Yes.
Right. It's what allows us to live in any sort of collective where it isn't just purely some sort of biker gang. Yes. Right. Law is absolutely primordial. The other thing is, what I think is very interesting that you're saying, the idea that when you've got a giant state or even some sort of nanny state or some sort of all-powerful centralized government, is that actually lowers civilization in all sorts of ways. The first thing that sprung to my mind is during the sort of the height of the Maoist period, in the sort of Great Leap Forward or the Cultural Revolution period, or even to some extent still today, where the government, the party, is sort of so all-powerful, they're supposed to provide absolutely everything for you. I'm talking not nowadays so much, but back in the 50s or 60s in China, that people would quite often, you had no property, there was no private property, everything was owned by the state. So at the end of the day of work, people would just literally drop their tools where they stood and walk away.
Yeah.
Because it's not theirs, it's not their property.
Yeah.
If that tool then rusts on the ground in the field, well, the idea at least in principle is the state will give you a new one. Right? And so in terms like that, civilization is at a very low ebb. The opposite, of course, is that when you have property, when the state isn't involved in you and what you own and what you do, then you've got a real motive in order to make it work. Yes. So yeah, everything you're saying is absolutely ringing true with me. The worry is, of course, that before we end up in a place like that, the what you described, where there's lots of sort of native or British enclaves that are sort of by working together through cooperating together through strictly means of just deliberately choosing to. There's no coercion in any way.
Yeah.
That's still a fair ways off, unfortunately, I feel like. You know, there's lots of processes, there's lots of stages between where we are today and a world like that.
Yes.
Do you think There's lots. There's lots more stages to go yet.
Yes, I think you're. I would say you're talking timescales in a way. Then, yeah.
So I'm wondering where you see us going in sort of the immediate future, in the next few years, or in the next, say, 10, 15, 20 years. Do you think things might collapse, the collapse you describe and talk about? Do you think that might happen actually quite quickly and not that far in the future? What's your feelings and thoughts on that?
The date that I've put on it, and I might risk making a fool of myself here, is about sometime around the end of this decade, so around 2030, maybe early 2030s. I think
not that long away in the scheme of things, in other words.
No, not that long away. The thing is, because I'm saying this, it's no good just to say it'll happen one day, because everything will happen one day. It needs to have a timeline on it. And that's the timeline I've chosen. I think things always take longer than you think they're going. It's always twice as, always set a timeline, so double the money and double the time scale. It could be twice that. But so far, I mean, I set that time scale for myself, I don't know, 5 years ago, maybe a bit more than that. And so far, I don't see any reason to draw back from that, because the crux point is when, historically, from my reading, is when the annual deficit of the government hits 20% of GDP. So it's not the size of the debt, it's annual deficit, overspend every year. So that was the case with the Soviet Union. It was the case with Latin American dictatorships when the governments kept falling over in the 80s and 90s in Latin America. Also with the inflations of Central Europe in the middle of the last century, when the state deficit hits 20% of GDP, that is when society becomes ungovernable. And really, I mean, simple terms, suddenly everyone says, I'm not working in this council office anymore. They haven't got the money to pay me. And the way I put it is the window cleaner at the council's offices, he'll suddenly say, I'm not doing this on invoice. You've got to pay me up front. And the local council will say, we haven't got the money to pay you up front. And he said, well, if I give you an invoice, I don't think you'll have the money then either. So I'm not doing it. I'm not cleaning your windows. And it gets, and you just get into a tailspin.
A systems collapse.
Yeah, a system. And feedback loop. System, that's the word I've been looking for all this time. System, accelerated by public anger and violence, because we are a decadent people. We have become decadent. We think that it is welfare is like rain that just distills out of the atmosphere, and it should. It's always been that way, and it always will be. And it's like oxygen to us. And when it goes, we will react the way we would if someone tried to cut off our oxygen supply. And so I think that will accelerate that system's collapse. People are probably going to come the 2030s, people are probably going to look at me and say, well, you got it wrong, it hasn't happened yet. Like the cult leader saying that the world's going to blow up in, you know, on 8 o'clock on Thursday morning.
Yeah.
But it's, I'm still sticking with that timetable because it looks about right. I think that state finances are a damn sight worse than they're letting on. So,
So just to follow up then on that idea of systems collapse, that's also something I sort of think about fairly regularly. There's an old 1970s, or I think maybe early 80s set of documentaries called Connections by James Burke. I don't know if you've ever seen that or watched it back in the day.
Yes.
It's absolutely superb. If anyone's out there, go, if you can find it, Connections. He talked a lot about something that was sort of underpinning all of it in a way, was this idea of systems collapse. And he was talking about that, even in the late 70s, early 80s, that you could have something like one small example he talked about, I think it's in the very first episode of the first season of it, is that you could have some sort of circuit breaker could go down in New York City, and it has some sort of feedback loop of causing, in the end, a giant power outage for a whole city, and suddenly all underground trains come to a halt, even hospitals suddenly don't have power, literally like that. Because one small part of a giant, giant interconnected system goes down. But if you talk about that on a societal level, not just on a city level, or even on a global scale, that one small thing fails, and then, for example, the worrying one is sort of power, or food supplier chains is that suddenly your local Tesco's or Sainsbury's or Waitrose or Lidl or even the corner shop, wherever it is, wherever you source your food from, within a few days or within a week or two, they're not getting any more physical food in. And you've got no way to get access to food, right? And if you don't know someone who owns an allotment, or you're unable to work an ancient-style plough, you haven't got any land, you don't know how to yoke a horse or an ox, you don't know how to work an ancient, unpowered plough, you can't work the land. So suddenly millions of people, really suddenly, within days or even a few weeks or a couple of months at most, millions of urban people are looking straight down the barrel of starving to death because they can't buy food from Tesco's anymore. Simple as that. You know, again, in the past, you look at historically, things like that can happen very quickly, very, very quickly. It didn't seem like that something like that was on the horizon. And now it is. And now it's here. It's with us. And all this is, I say all that, to lead into the idea how this plays into our invasion and foreign enclaves and everything we've been talking about so far in this conversation. It could happen, whether it's 5 years from now, 50 years from now. And when that happens, it will probably, in fact, it's more likely to happen quickly. Do you think so?
Yeah, very. And the fun one to think about is London. What's the population of Greater London? Is it 10 million? Maybe more.
More Greater London, isn't it? More, I think it's more, sorry.
It might be 50.
It's a giant metropolis. It's one of the biggest cities in the world, right, London? It's in the top 10 or 20 biggest cities in the world.
Yeah, and it's full of the 57 varieties, and all with their own gangs and their own identities, all with claims to turf. And let's suppose you don't need to go so far as James Burt. You don't need to have a collapse of electricity or anything. Just suppose there's a breakdown of law somehow. So you're getting, say, the Southport riots spread around the country and the police are all occupied with that, or no one's getting sent, or the courts break down or something, then how long is it going to take for those supermarkets to get looted bare?
Yeah,
20 minutes? 20 minutes, probably.
Look at the LA riots. Sorry?
Go ahead.
I'll just say, look at the LA riots. In fact, there's lots and lots of examples of that, something like that happening. Law breaks down briefly, a small window of time, and everything's looted. Like a plague of locusts, immediately. Sorry, go ahead. Continue, please. Sorry.
And if you get a breakdown of law, then no one has any food in London. I mean, it's a food desert, and people might have a couple of meals worth in their cupboards. Then within a short space of time, you get a lot of conflict. And it could really, I'd say, could be very, very nasty, sort of multipolar, all against all, multipolar conflict. And that it's not very. And then let's suppose the Tesco lorry wants to battle its way through to bring food in. That's going to get hijacked. And then, so are there enough soldiers to ride shotgun on every Tesco, Lidl, Sainsbury's, Waitrose, every supermarket lorry? Probably not. It's not our job to ride shotgun on supermarket lorries. That I think backs up my point about ethnic separation. In those circumstances, I think people will say, I'm in a desperate situation here. Who can I trust and rely on, not only for safety, for security, but also just to help me survive? I think you'll see people very quickly flying back to the people they instinctively trust. Going back to primal, the sense of primal trust. Who can I? It's who looks like me. Historically, that's how you tell who you can trust. Well, he doesn't look like me. I reckon he's from the next village over. So he might eat my babies and rape my wife. So I'll kill him because he's just got a slightly different shade of hair or something like that.
So he's from the next valley. He cannot be trusted. Yeah, right. Obviously, that is again a sort of a nightmarish vision of the future, but. In that sort of scenario, I sort of fear that places like allotments or just open fields, arable land, becomes the battlegrounds. You know, that if there are allotments that are actually capable of growing some carrots and potatoes and things, that then you get you get conflict over control of those. It passes from the hands of a well-meaning, middle-aged, older person who spent a ton of time and energy on their allotment. Suddenly it becomes, no, the most violent, brutal gang from the nearby urban area sees it for themselves. Yeah. Again, that's just, a nightmarish sort of thing that may well play out.
But if you think about that, then how will ordinary British people react to that? I think ordinary British people react to that by saying there's a nasty gang just the other side of town. It may be a Muslim gang or an African gang. We need, and they love to come running through and stealing what they can and just looting what they can. We need to get up our own, we need to club together so that we can protect ourselves. Like, and it's not just that I've got a few chickens, and those, I'm well aware what'll happen to those. In that, with the situation you're talking, those chickens will be stolen and eaten. So to hell with the eggs, they're gonna be stolen and eaten. So I might have the incentive to club together with people just to protect my chickens, say, something like that. But it goes wider than that. Ordinary people would say, we've got to club together because the farmer, he's not giving his food away to us, but if he can't produce, we're going to have nothing to buy. So we have to be able to protect our own society, our own productive infrastructure. Right. So again, and when you get people wanting to club together, the next question people ask is, well, what are the rules here? So if I say club together with me, I mean, people are going to say, well, and by the way, you've got to pay £1,000 a year to join. They're going to say, well, what are you going to do with the money? So people want, this leads me to think that people will, again, rush to join some kind of legal, transparent legal system, because it's nicer than having to submit to a gang lord, a rogue colonel, or some theocrat, or a mafia don, someone like that, which is what people do in crises like that.
Some sort of collective where you, at least on some level, you've chosen yeah. it. So, okay, to start wrapping up, unfortunately, I could talk to you for ages, but we've got a finite amount of time. And again, thank you for your time. Really, really appreciate it. Let's not leave it too long before you come back on again. But so what would you say to people then? Because we were talking about things that are probably quite a way in the future yet. You know, at least 5-10 years at least. What would you say to people that are thinking along our lines or on our side of the equation politically? Yeah. What would you say to them now, today, in the immediate future? What could they do, you know, practically? What's your advice to anyone that wants to actually, as you said, fed up with just looking at the computer screen or the TV screen and feeling outraged? What's your advice?
I would say just find something you can do that you can contribute, so you're not just getting carried along with it. So that might mean... That might mean joining some political organisation, subscribing to you and to or following you, and just for me, it was stopping
giving you a bit of money so you can bust some mosques.
Yeah. That would be something that people could do, or go on a letter writing campaign, writing letters to the politicians, because it is a nuisance for them. It's a or submitting. One thing that I think people could do is submit freedom of information requests to central government, because they are a real pain and they hate those. They hate being accountable. They hate having to provide information, and they'll get up any excuse not to provide it. And then when they do that, you appeal the failure to provide the information, which is just such a headache, and that you get them tearing their hair out. Or ideally find some organization that's doing good work and just do something, because then you feel less. You don't feel so powerless. And then when it does, those are the people who get up, people who do something are the people who get up fastest when it falls over. So that's what I'd say to people in the immediate term. Probably, what would I say? I think I would, the other thing is try and have good relations with your neighbours or your local community is the word that's used, but it's such a misused word. I mean, try and make good relations to people. The way I do is I said I keep chickens. When I have too many eggs, I give them away to the neighbours, so they all like me. And so that's a, so, and it's your neighbours are going to protect you. And also, the, I think the other thing, the simple thing actually, is just being aware. So again, I think following someone like you, watching what you say, if you're aware, if people are aware of what might happen, that is the best protector. If someone's like just rolling in money, but they're completely stupid and woke, their money's not going to protect them. Mm. Someone who understands what's coming and is prepared for it, they'll survive.
I think one of the things you said there, which I would just completely agree with, is do something. That would be my advice to people, is do something. Like when you're stuck in a ridiculous, terrible survival situation, keep making decisions. They might be wrong, but if you're just paralysed and do nothing, then you're definitely doomed. Do something. Oh, it's just cut off. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, sure can.
Oh, sorry. The screen went blank just for a moment there. So you've come back now. I'll probably cut that bit out in post. Sorry, I'll carry on. People to do something, whatever your skills are. There's some people on our side of the equation, on the DR, the distant right, whatever you want to call it, that say there's no point doing anything. Only elites can control anything. I just disagree with that completely. I feel like I feel like there's the old adage or the cliche, whatever you want to call it, of that power lies with, or history is moved by, those that turn up.
Yeah.
So if you don't turn up, if you don't do something, if you don't say anything, then you are definitely doomed. You might be anyway, but you definitely will be if you don't do something. Try something. That was one of the things you said there, and I completely agree with that. Yeah. So, and I think what you do is absolutely invaluable. It's God's work. It's incredible, really. It's a real shame that there aren't an army of you guys out there, lawyers that are actually, you know, trying to prevent this sort of sectarian, balkanized nightmare. You've argued that actually we need to get there before things can remigration can truly happen. But anyway, are there any other sort of final thoughts or feelings you've got, Gavin, that you want to leave us with?
Yeah, to encourage people to try and do something. We are the power in the land. People like you and me and people who are doing something. We are the ones driving opinion. And you can see that in us, remigrators, the people who are talking about remigration and how to do it and the extent that it should be done. You've got all the lesser, the sort of the people, the followers of Nigel Farage. They're all trying to catch up. So they're sort of trying to hint that, oh, I'm in favour of it as well. I want to see a few deportations. I want to see like a dozen firebrand imams kicked out. So I'm on the same side as you. I'm as edgy as you. They're all to everyone. And we're the ones driving opinion. And government is driven by opinion. Starmer and the likes, they don't really have very much power. They're driven by opinion. And that opinion is set by us. We are tomorrow's legislators today. We're the ones who are doing it. So it is the opposite of being powerless. Just do something, you'll enjoy it. And watch yourselves get the rabbit on the run. It's fun.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. We are the music makers, we are the dreamers of dreams. I think one of the worst, most pernicious lies that are told to people is that you can't do anything, is that you're powerless, is that your voice, Your hands are of no use. It's not worth even trying. No, that's the enemy speaking. That's the devil telling you can't win, so don't try. I don't accept that, and I know you don't because you live it every day.
Thank you.
All right, great, Gavin. Thank you very, very much for your time. To everyone out there, I hope you've enjoyed that, and hopefully we'll get Mr. Baby back before too long. So until next time, take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, we'll do the rest in post-production. Great. Okay, well, yeah, I wasn't just blowing smoke up your ass there. I would love to have you back before too long. How long was it? It's like 2 years, was it, last time we spoke? Too long ago.
I guess so.
It's got to be up and around that time. So, but no, it was a great conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope we hit some of the points you wanted to hit and stuff.
Yeah, very much.
I would have liked to, because of the producers, we do have to stop it there. But next time I would like to have talked more about talking about sort of the Farageists, or that even people like Tommy Robinson or Lawrence Fox are still lagging behind. They're not quite got the balls to talk about mass remigration. and stuff. But yeah, maybe we can talk about that in a bit of detail next time.
Yeah, that would be fun.
All right, great. So this won't go, just to let you know, this won't go out all that soon because we're doing this as an interview. We've got different types of content.
Yeah.
And this is we're classing this as an interview. All that means is, unfortunately, is that it has to go on the back burner with some other ones. But still, I would have thought we'll get it on our website within 2 weeks. It might be sooner, it might be a bit longer, but it's probably that ballpark before it's on the website. I hope that's all right with you.
No, I trust you. I understand that it's involved. I understand.
Great. Oh, because we've just got a big backlog, and our bottleneck here at Lotus Eaters is the backstaff production people that actually put all the videos together. That is our bottleneck, and they've just got, there's things we've recorded weeks ago that they're working on now. So it's only fair that, you know, it goes in its place in the thing. So yeah, probably realistically, probably a couple of weeks before this goes out. But it wasn't particularly time sensitive what we were talking about, so that would be fine. And I'll let you know on Twitter or somehow that when it's going up, and send you a link and stuff. Obviously, feel free to share it or do whatever you want with it.
Thank you. I'll publicise it.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
All right.
Well,
and I hope I don't get you into trouble.
Yeah. No worries. All right. Is there anything else?
No, that was a great pleasure. Thanks for giving me the time.
No, thank you. It's our pleasure. So I'm going to go get my production guys to turn the cameras off, turn the stream off and all that sort of thing. So until next time, Gavin.
Thanks very much.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right Rug.